I have to ask you something and be honest here. How many times this week have you read a headline or maybe a really passionate social media thread and thought, wow, that is definitely true?
Oh, I mean, constantly.
Right. But then you scroll down like 2 inches, you read a counter thread, and you suddenly think, oh, wait, actually, that second thing is definitely true.
Yeah, only about a dozen times before breakfast, honestly.
Yeah.
It's just the modern condition, isn't it? We are completely drowning in information, but at the exact same time, we're starving for actual certainty.
It really feels like we're living in a world of just, hot takes. Everything is an opinion. Everything is relative. If you argue loud enough, you're right.
Which is exhausting.
It is genuinely exhausting. It makes you want to delete all the apps and go live in a cabin somewhere. But before we do that, I want to see if we can solve this problem or, at least understand it a bit better by going way back.
We are going back to the absolute source code of Western thought today.
Exactly. We are doing a deep dive into Plato. Specifically, we're looking at his epistemology. And look, I know epistemology sounds like some kind of rare medical condition, but it's really just the fancy philosophical term for asking, how do we know what is actually real?
Right. It's essentially the toolkit for distinguishing between a shadow and the actual object casting that shadow.
And to guide us on this deep dive, we are using a really fantastic lecture series on the history of philosophy by Dr. Arthur Holmes.
It's a great series. He breaks down four of Plato's biggest hits, basically: the Meno, the Phaedo, the Republic, and the Symposium.
And what struck me immediately in Holmes's lecture is that Plato wasn't just, writing these dialogues in a vacuum for fun. He was in a literal intellectual cage match with a group called the Sophists.
Oh, absolutely. And to understand Plato, you really have to understand the Sophists first. Think of them as sort of the original spin doctors or high-priced political consultants.
Right, they were traveling teachers.
Exactly. They would come into a town and say, "Hey, pay me, and I can teach you how to win absolutely any argument."
But they weren't saying, I can teach you the truth.
No, truth was completely irrelevant to them. They were strict relativists. They famously believed that man is the measure of all things.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning, if you think the room is cold, it's cold. If I think it's warm, it's warm. There's no actual objective temperature. There's just our individual perceptions. And if you can persuade the crowd that your version of reality is right, well, then you win.
Which, I mean, that sounds dangerously like my social media feed right now.
It's highly modern, isn't it? And Plato looked at that chaos, this society where justice and truth were just treated as matters of opinion or whoever had the best PR, and he said, "This is a total disaster."
He wanted a way
He
out.
wanted a roadmap to universals.
Yeah.
He was looking for things that are true for everyone, everywhere, all the time, completely, regardless of how good your debate skills are.
So let's look at his first attempt to really pin this down. Dr. Holmes starts us with a dialogue called the Meno. And the central question driving this text is something we actually still argue about today, which is, can virtue be taught?
It sounds like a simple, almost administrative policy question, right? Like, if we want a good society, we obviously need good people. So can we just set up a curriculum to teach kids to be virtuous, the exact same way we teach them geometry or grammar?
And this is where Plato drops a really funny, almost cynical observation. He basically says, okay, look around Athens, look at the really great statesmen, guys like Pericles or Themistocles. These are the giants of our society, the virtuous men. And then look at their
It's
kids.
such a brutal takedown because historically, the sons of these incredibly great men were very often absolute disasters. They were mediocre, spoiled, and sometimes just straight up villains.
Right, so Plato's logic here is if Pericles really knew what virtue was, if he held it in his hand like a concrete piece of knowledge, he obviously would have taught it to his son.
Naturally, you don't let your own kid grow up to be a monster if you literally have the cure sitting in your brain.
So the conclusion has to be that Pericles didn't actually know virtue. But wait a minute. Pericles was virtuous. He did genuinely good things for Athens. So how can a guy be virtuous but not actually know what virtue is? That feels like a massive contradiction.
And this is the crucial distinction that Dr. Holmes highlights. It's a difference between knowledge and what Plato calls right opinion.
Right opinion.
Yes, Pericles had right opinion. He had a knack for doing the right thing. He had excellent instincts, a good gut feeling.
Okay, but let's say I have a gut feeling that a certain stock is going to go up and I buy it and it does go up. I'm just as rich as the financial analyst who did all the math. So, practically speaking, what is the actual difference between a lucky guess and real knowledge?
In the short term, absolute nothing.
Yeah.
If you guess the road to the next city correctly, you still get to the city just as fast as the guy with the map. But Plato uses this wonderful metaphor in the Meno to explain the danger here involving the mythical statues of Daedalus.
Oh, the moving statues.
Right. The myth says Daedalus was such a genius sculptor that he made statues so lifelike they actually had to be tied down with heavy ropes, or else they would literally run away in the middle of the night.
That's a great image.
It is. And Plato says, right, opinions are exactly like those statues. They are highly valuable, they are beautiful, but they are entirely untethered.
What does he mean they run away? How does an opinion run away?
They flee when your circumstances change. Because opinions are just based on sense perception, what you see and feel in a specific moment. But the physical world is messy and always changing.
So if things get difficult.
Exactly. If your virtue is just a habit or a good feeling, what happens when you're suddenly put in a high-pressure situation you've never seen before? A crisis? Your opinion might just bolt. You'll panic.
So Pericles could do the right thing when things were relatively normal or familiar, but he couldn't explain the underlying reason why it was the right thing. So he couldn't pass it on to his son. He literally couldn't tie the statue down.
Precisely. To turn a mere opinion into actual knowledge, you have to tether it. You have to tie it down. And the rope you use for that is what Plato calls working out the reason why. You have to anchor your belief in a universal principle that simply does not change.
And the main tool we use to tie that knot, according to Plato, is dialectic.
Dialectic. Now, in modern English, that word kind of just sounds like dialogue or debate. But for Plato, it's much more rigorous than that.
How so?
It's the intense process of cross-examining an idea. You strip away all the specific physical details, the personal emotions, the relative circumstances, until you finally hit the absolute bedrock principle that remains true in all cases.
But this leads us to the part of the deep dive where my brain honestly started to hurt a little bit, because Dr. Holmes explains that when we do this, when we use dialectic to find the truth, Plato says we aren't actually learning anything new.
No, not at all. We are simply remembering.
This is his theory of recollection. And I need you to walk me through this because it sounds a bit like a sci-fi movie.
It's definitely wild to modern ears, but it's deeply tied to Plato's view of the human soul. He believes the soul is entirely eternal. Before you were born into your current body, your soul existed in a realm of pure reality.
Pure reality.
Yes. You didn't just see good things up there. You saw goodness itself. You saw the absolute truth.
Okay, so I'm hanging out in the eternal ether, knowing literally everything.
Yeah.
Then what happens?
Then you get born. And for Plato, birth is a profoundly traumatic event. It's a massive shock to your system. Dr. Holmes jokes that it's essentially like getting hit on the head with a giant stick.
So you get amnesia.
Total amnesia. You forget every single thing you knew in that higher realm.
Meaning we are all just walking around right now with total, absolute amnesia.
We have innate knowledge. It's buried deep, deep in there, but we just can't consciously access it. So learning, in Plato's view, isn't stuffing brand new facts into an empty head. It's a process called anamnesis.
Unforgetting.
Exactly. It's unforgetting. It's the slow recovery of what you already inherently know. Dialectic is just the conversational tool that jogs your memory.
That is a very lovely, poetic idea. But is there actually any logical reason to believe that? Or is this just Plato being kind of mystical and weird?
It's not just mysticism. Holmes brings up a classic, highly logical argument from another dialogue, the Phaedo, regarding the concept of equality. It's actually a very tight puzzle.
Walk me through it.
Imagine I hold up two wooden sticks. You look at them and you say, okay, these sticks are equal in length.
Sure, happens all the time.
But look closer. Put them under a high-powered microscope. Are they perfectly mathematically equal?
No, obviously not. One is going to be a fraction of a millimeter longer or have a weird bump on the bark. Nothing in the physical world is actually mathematically perfect.
Right. You have never, in your entire human life, seen two physical things that are perfectly equal. You have only ever seen things that are almost equal.
Okay, I'm with you so far.
So here is Plato's trap. How can you look at two sticks and judge that they fall short of perfect equality if you have never in your life seen perfect equality? You can't compare a flawed copy to an original if you've never actually laid eyes on the original.
That's actually a bit disturbing to think about.
Right. Since you couldn't have possibly gotten the pure concept of perfect equality from this messy, imperfect physical world, you must have brought the concept with you. It's a standard of judgment you possessed before you even had physical eyes.
So every single time I judge something in the real world, every time I say, hey, that's not fair, or wow, that's not beautiful, I'm subconsciously comparing the thing right in front of me to a perfect template I'm carrying around in my amnesiac soul.
Exactly. The physical world just acts as a trigger. Seeing the slightly unequal sticks reminds you of the perfect equality you forgot when you were born.
Wow. And this really sets up the big picture of his whole philosophy. We are stuck in a physical world that is just a messy, imperfect copy of a real, perfect world located somewhere else.
Which naturally leads us to the single most famous image in all of Western philosophy.
The allegory of the cave.
From the Republic.
Even if you've never read a page of philosophy, you've probably heard of the cave. But I want to re-examine it today through this specific lens of amnesia and remembering. Paint the picture for us.
Imagine a deep, dark, underground cave. Inside, there are prisoners who have been chained up, facing the blank back wall, since the day they were born.
They can't turn their heads at all.
Not even an inch. Behind them, way up a steep slope, there's a large fire burning. And between that fire and the chained prisoners, other people are walking along a raised path, holding up objects like wooden puppets of animals, pots, statues.
But the chained prisoners can't see the people or the actual objects?
No, the fire casts shadows of those objects onto the wall in front of the prisoners. And because shadows are literally the only things these prisoners have ever seen in their entire lives, they fully believe those shadows are true reality.
So if a shadow of a carved lion passes by and someone echoes a roar, they think the flat shadow itself just roared.
Yes. This is their whole universe. Just flat, flickering shadows on a stone wall.
And Plato says, that is us.
That is us. That is our normal daily life. The laptop you're looking at, the coffee cup on your desk, the latest political scandal in the news, these are all just shadows. Plato calls them physical particulars.
Because they change.
Exactly. They come into being, they change shape, they break down, they disappear. They simply aren't the ultimate eternal reality.
And the philosopher is the guy who somehow snaps the chains.
Right. He breaks free, he turns around. And at first, looking at the actual fire completely blinds him. It hurts his eyes. But eventually he realizes the shadows were fake. Then he is dragged up this rough, steep, painful ascent out of the cave and finally out into the blinding sunlight of the real world.
And what does the sun represent up there?
The sun represents what Plato calls the forms, the universal truths. Ultimately, it's the good itself. It's the eternal source of all truth and all existence, just like our physical sun is the source of light.
But Dr. Holmes points out something really important here. Plato doesn't just say, hey, step out of the cave, good luck. He actually gives us a highly specific map to get there. He describes a ladder of knowledge called the divided line.
This map is totally essential for understanding how Plato thinks education should work. Imagine a vertical line cut into four distinct sections. The bottom two sections represent being trapped inside the cave, and the top two sections represent being outside in the real world.
So take us through it. Level one, the absolute bottom of the barrel.
Level one is images or illusion, shadows, reflections in water, hallucinations. In our modern world, this would be stuff like pure hearsay, baseless rumors, or maybe AI-generated deepfakes.
It's the furthest possible thing from the truth.
Exactly. Then you move up to level two.
Which is?
Physical objects. This is the realm of belief. It's the actual wooden stick or the actual human politician. Now, this is definitely better than an illusion, but because physical things are constantly decaying and changing, you can never have true, locked-down scientific knowledge of them.
You can only have those runaway opinions we talked about earlier.
Right. So to get real knowledge, we have to cross the line. We have to completely leave the sensory world behind and enter the mind. That brings us to level three.
Level three.
Mathematical reasoning.
And I have to admit, this is exactly where I got stuck in the lecture. Why math? Why on earth is geometry the specific gateway to spiritual enlightenment?
It seems weird, right?
Yeah.
But it's because math forces you to stop looking at the messy physical world. Think about it. When you do geometry, you might draw a triangle on a dusty chalkboard.
Yeah.
That physical drawing is terribly imperfect.
Yeah.
The chalk lines are thick, the angles aren't exact, but your mind isn't actually thinking about the chalk dust, is it? It's thinking about the abstract triangle, the perfect, unchanging definition of a triangle.
Oh, I see. So it's kind of like training wheels for your brain.
It's the mental gym. Math trains your intellect to safely detach from physical objects and handle pure abstract concepts. Plato actually had a sign over the door of his academy that famously said, "Let no one ignorant of geometry enter here." He was dead serious. If you can't think abstractly about a triangle, you have zero hope of thinking abstractly about justice or virtue.
But that makes total sense. And that finally brings us to the top. Level four.
Dialectic, the highest form of reason. See, in math, you still have to rely on unproven assumptions, basic axioms like 1 plus 1 equals 2. You just assume they're true and work downward.
Right.
But in level 4, you question the assumptions themselves. You use dialectic to climb all the way up to the first principles, the forms themselves, until you finally see the whole interconnected web of truth without relying on any physical images at all. Yeah. You finally see the good.
Okay, I have to play the skeptic again here because this all sounds incredibly, well, cold. It sounds like to get out of the cave, I essentially need to become a logic robot. I need to strip away all my messy human feelings and just be a calculating machine. Is there any room in this philosophy for actual human emotion?
You know, that is the single most common criticism of Plato, that he's just this icy, cold rationalist. But Dr. Holmes pulls something brilliant from the dialogue called the Symposium that completely flips that entire script.
Oh.
Holmes argues that you absolutely cannot get out of the cave using logic alone. You actually need eros.
Eros, as in, you know, erotica.
Well, we have completely ruined that word in modern English. We hear eros and we just think it means sex or romance. But for the ancient Greeks, eros was a much broader concept. It meant desiring love.
Desiring love.
Yes, it is a deep craving. It is a physical and spiritual hunger. Plato argues in the Symposium that the philosopher must actually have an eros for the truth. You have to be desperately in love with reality.
So it's not just solving a cold intellectual puzzle. You have to actively want it.
You have to crave the truth the way a drowning man craves oxygen. Because think about the cave. Dragging yourself up that rocky path into the blinding sun is agonizing. If you don't have a burning passion driving you, you will never endure the pain. You'll just turn around and go back to watching the comfortable shadows.
But Holmes points out a pretty massive paradox here. A vicious circle, really.
It's a huge psychological problem. We established earlier that we all have amnesia. We don't even know the upper truth exists. So how can you possibly love something if you don't even know it's there?
Right. If I'm a chained prisoner, I love the shadows. They are my entertainment. They're my whole world. I have absolutely no reason to desire the sun. So how do you start the engine? Where does the eros come from?
Plato's answer to the vicious circle is education. But he means something radically different from the kind of education we have today. In The Republic, he talks about shaping the very soul of a young child through two primary disciplines.
What are they?
Music and gymnastics.
Music and gym class. The exact two things that get cut first when a modern school budget gets tight.
It is deeply ironic, yes.
Yeah.
But we have to clarify his terms. By gymnastics, he didn't mean playing dodgeball or climbing a rope. He meant strict military drill.
Like choreography.
Exactly.
Yep.
Moving the physical body in perfect, rational unison with others. It teaches the physical body to love order. It imposes a rational structure on your wild physical movements.
And what about music?
He believed that exposing a young child to harmonious, mathematically structured music actually bypasses the intellect completely and sinks straight into the subconscious.
So you're basically programming them.
You are training their affections. You teach the child to feel deep pleasure when things are orderly and harmonious, and to feel visceral disgust when things are chaotic or discordant. And you do all of this long before they are old enough to even understand complex logic.
So you are basically priming the pump. You build up this subconscious emotional love for order in the kid so that years later, when they finally grow up and meet real philosophy, when they finally encounter logic, their heart immediately says, yes, I know this. This feels like home.
Precisely. You simply cannot teach high-level philosophy to a chaotic, disordered soul. You have to prepare the character to receive the truth first.
It's really a stunning vision of what education should be. It's not about giving kids job skills to go make money. It's literal soul craft.
And that profound vision is exactly why Plato has had such a massive historical legacy, which is the final piece of our deep dive today. Dr. Holmes points out that this entire structure, the cave, the two worlds, the absolute need for a change of heart, it basically laid out a red carpet for Christianity centuries later.
I can totally see that. The early church fathers must have read The Republic and thought, wait a minute, this sounds very familiar.
St. Augustine certainly did. He saw Platonism as the perfect philosophical vessel to explain Christian theology. Plato's eternal world of forms easily became the mind of God. The sun outside the cave became the divine light of God.
And the journey out of the cave.
That became the Christian soul's difficult pilgrimage from the flawed city of man up to the perfect city of God.
It perfectly echoes that biblical idea to set your affections on things above, not on things on the earth.
Exactly. For over 1,000 years of Western history, you practically couldn't separate Christian theology from Platonic philosophy. They were entirely intertwined.
And Holmes also connects this Platonic ideal to the concept of the liberal arts today, right? He mentions the philosopher Alan Bloom and the focus on the great books.
Yes. This is the ultimate defense of a liberal arts education. People always ask, why do we bother reading these old, dusty books? Why study philosophy or ancient history if it doesn't teach you how to write code or balance a corporate spreadsheet?
Because coding in spreadsheets are, in Plato's view, just manipulating shadows on the cave wall.
That is exactly the argument. Pure vocational training just teaches you how to be a highly successful prisoner. It teaches you how to accurately predict which shadow is going to slide past the wall next.
But the liberal arts.
The liberal arts, doing actual dialectic, is an attempt to break the chains. It's an attempt to figure out what a human being actually is, what the good is, and how to live a life that actually matters outside the cave.
It really reframes that overwhelming feeling of information overload we talked about at the very start of the show.
It really does. We are swimming in a sea of right opinion at best and complete illusion at worst. We are totally obsessed with the shadows on our screens. And Plato is reaching across two millennia to challenge us to stop, look at the chaos and say, this isn't enough.
It's a call to find the tether, to find the solid thing that absolutely does not change when the daily news cycle shifts.
And, more importantly, to recognize that the deep hunger you feel for something real, that profound frustration you have with the daily noise, is actually your biggest asset. It's that Eros we talked about, trying to wake you up.
That is a perfect place to wrap up our deep dive for today.
I do have just one final, slightly provocative thought to leave you with, though.
Go for it.
We talked about the vicious circle, how we need to love the truth to find it, but we need to find it to love it. And Plato relies on that buried spark of memory to get the whole process started. So, as you go about your week, pay close attention to your own curiosity. When you feel that sudden, unexplainable, burning need to understand something deeply, where is that actually coming from? Is it just random brain chemistry firing off? Or is it possible that your curiosity is actually a memory of something perfect that you've lost?
That is definitely something to chew on. Thanks so much for joining us on this deep dive, and we'll see you all next time.